Shalom and welcome to On the House, the podcast where industry experts and professionals discuss real estate in Israel. I'm your host, Debbie Goldfischer, real estate agent, founder and editor-in-chief of buyitinisrael.com. Join us as we explore market trends, legal and tax issues, purchasing tips, neighborhoods throughout Israel, and much more. All this is On the House, helping you make the right move. Welcome to the next episode of On the House. This week, we're diving into one of the most crucial steps you should take before making a purchase of a pre-owned home in Israel, and that is bringing in a professional engineer to conduct a thorough inspection. A careful evaluation of a home's structural integrity, safety standards, and potential renovation challenges can make all the difference between a smart purchase and a big headache. To guide us through this important topic, I'm excited to introduce Robert Ferris, founder of SEO, a structural engineering practice in Israel. Robert is both a chartered structural engineer in the UK and a registered engineer in Israel, making him uniquely equipped to understand the nuances of both local and international standards. In this episode, Robert will share his expertise on what buyers should look for in a property inspection, common structural pitfalls to avoid, and how engineering insights can help you make an informed, confident decision when purchasing a home in Israel. So whether you're considering a modest apartment or a large renovation project, this episode will equip you with valuable knowledge and great tips. Let's get started. Robert, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. On a personal note, it's a pleasure to have a British guest this time. Most of my guests are American or Israeli and it's good. It keeps my accent a little bit stronger. When I speak to Americans, it gets watered down. Robert, before we dive into our topic, tell us a little bit about what you do, where you work and how you got into this.
I'm a structural engineer. I trained in England and made Aliyah 8 years ago.
Fantastic.
My day job is I design towers and low-rise buildings across the country. And I work with architects to do that. And I became a bit of an expert in reinforced concrete buildings, which happily is what the majority of residential properties are in Israel. So then someone suggested, why don't I do inspections? Because in England, it's often a surveyor that does this job, whereas that role doesn't really exist here and it's mainly done by an engineer. And for Anglos who are buying a property here, it's often hard to decipher these reports because they're written in Hebrew. So someone suggested, why don't I do it? So basically, I found a way that I could juggle both my day job and my evenings and weekends job.
I'm very interested in what you do during the day, but you know what? We're going to save that for another episode on designing buildings.
Designing buildings,
like private homes. If somebody wants to build a private home, they buy a plot of land.
Yeah, sure.
That's the sort of thing you design the building?
Well, in my day job, it's mainly larger projects. For example, a tower, a high-rise building in Tel Aviv, something that I would work on.
Or unbelievable.
A Lazarov underground station in Tel Aviv.
And you work for a company or this is your own?
I work for a company.
Wonderful. Okay, so today we're going to focus on your evening weekend job, which is inspecting pre-owned properties, right? As opposed to new construction, because that's a different conversation. And we actually spoke a few months ago with our friend Ira Braverman all about new construction. So before we dive into the specifics of what happens during a property inspection, let's first take a step back and look at homes in Israel as a whole. Homes here are built quite differently than in other countries, with unique materials, climate conditions, and environmental factors to consider. Can you walk us through the general construction practices in Israel? How durable are these homes over time, and what are some common issues that you typically encounter?
Sure. So your typical home from an apartment building or private home is generally the structural frame is reinforced concrete. So the floors, the structural elements, so the structural walls, the structural columns are all reinforced concrete. Between them, you have blockwork walls. So they're non-load bearing walls, which are made of breeze blocks. Often in America, you'll find that they're timber stud walls. But here, the non-load bearing aspect, the construction is blockwork. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in the newer buildings, they are done with stud walls like they're done in America.
What do you mean by stud walls?
So basically, you'll have a series of kind of small steel columns at every 40 centimeters. You'll have a series of columns and that will mm-hmm. make up a wall and then it's bound together by some plasterboard to give you a wall finish. And you often find that in newer buildings, in high-rise buildings, but typically in like a low-rise apartment building or in private home, the non-load bearing walls are done with breeze blocks and there's often plasterboard walls as well.
In England, they're built with bricks.
In England, yeah. So you have masonry bricks and breeze blocks as well. Mm-hmm. So bricks on the outside, breeze blocks on the inside. And then you'll have timber joist floors, which is basically a series of wooden beams in the floors. And that's covered with some plywood. Whereas here, you have a concrete floor. The main reason, there's two big reasons for that. The first reason is because we live in a seismic zone, so it's earthquake country, and reinforced concrete is a lot easier to design for earthquakes too. And the other thing is we have bomb shelter in every house, in every apartment by law, and that needs to be designed, that needs to be built from reinforced concrete. So once you're already building one part of your house or one part of your apartment with reinforced concrete, it makes sense to continue that type of construction everywhere else.
Very interesting. I thought you were going to say perhaps the climate also contributes towards this decision because it's so hot here. We want to keep the heat out of the homes as opposed to keeping them in. Like in England, the bricks insulate the homes and keep them warm. Here, it's actually hard to keep the homes warm in the winter.
That's true. And that's to do with kind of the thermal properties of concrete and whether how well insulated the home is. And sometimes it's done very well, particularly newer buildings. And sometimes in a lot of the older buildings, there's less good insulation sometimes.
Interesting. Okay. So in terms of durability of homes in Israel over time, I often see that apartment buildings or apartments that are not that old seem to be quite run down and they wear pretty quickly. Is that something that you notice or has that been improved in recent years? And if so, you know, why is this the case?
Yeah, that's a good observation. If you look at a home in England or the US that's maybe 30 years old, it's going to be in pretty good condition because there have been really quite high level of building codes for a long period of time. Whereas in Israel, the building codes are relatively new in terms of construction. And as a result, the building codes are often copies of the European standards or the American standard. So I think it depends where you're buying a place. So for example, if you're buying in relatively new neighborhoods such as Modi'in, Tanya, then all the buildings are relatively new. They're all designed to the latest building codes and they tend to be in a lot better condition relative to their age than somewhere else.
Makes sense. So when somebody's looking to buy, it's obviously important to look at the age of the building and the standards to which it was built.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay, so as we've already discussed with Jay Norman, our lawyer, a couple of weeks ago, conducting a structural inspection before purchasing a property in Israel is critical. It should always be a contingency in the transaction, giving you the option to walk away if you're not satisfied with the property's condition. Very importantly, this is something that must be done before you sign an agreement, because once the contract is signed, there are no contingencies and you're committed. So Robert, let's say somebody has called you in for an inspection of a home before they buy the property. Could you walk us through the key steps of a property inspection? What do you do?
So my job ultimately is to identify defects in the home and work out where they've come from, work out how to fix it so that it doesn't come back again, and provide a cost for that repair work. So the kind of thing that I do is firstly, obviously, structure is the most important thing, because if a building is failing structurally, that's the biggest red flag. You just want to walk away from that. So for example, if there's subsidence in the building, let's say it's a house and it's got significant cracking, then it could be subsidence and it's very expensive. Obviously, you can repair it, but it's very expensive to repair such things. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on how much damage has already been done to the building. I've never seen a building with significant subsidence here in terms of the inspections. With my other hat on, I have, but with slightly older buildings. But yeah, so the first thing is subsidence or general structural cracking. I go around, I look at all the walls, all the floors, I identify if there are any cracks in them, work out why the reason for the crack, and then determine whether it's a significant issue or it's just something that's superficial that's expected. So that's the primary thing that I do. The next things are going around looking for leaks, looking for waterproofing. I do high-level checks on the electrics, high-level checks on the air conditioning and the plumbing.
When you say you do high-level checks on the water, the plumbing, on the electricity, what do you do?
That's actually a really important point. So here, to sign off on electrics, you have to be a licensed electrician. I'm not. I'm an engineer. I'm a structural engineer. So I can't sign off on things like that. I just do simple checks that, like, does the plug socket work? Is the plug socket done to code? Are the light switches working? that kind of thing. And likewise with the air conditioning, the plumbing, like I'm not an expert in those areas. So I always say, I've checked, does it work? I've looked out for issues that could have arisen from it. However, before you move in, I always recommend getting these professions, so an electrician, a plumber, and an AC technician, just to go in and give things a quick service. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they tend not to be game changers, determining whether or not you're going to buy this apartment or buy this house.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very important. So if we break it down into different focus areas, you say you've got the structure of the building you're looking at, the water, electricity. Are you looking for subsidence?
And also there's leaks, waterproofing. Is there a leak from the balcony? Is there a leak from the roof?
How do you check that?
Firstly, determine, look at the walls and look for evidence of water or of damp. And also, by the way, there can be leaks from pipes. So often in apartment buildings, particularly older ones, I find leaks around pipes, which are communal pipes, which may be a drain pipe from the apartment above. And it's leaking into the apartment that I'm inspecting. And that's obviously not something that you have much control over. And that's something that I often pass on to the lawyers and say, please investigate this, see whether there's been any claims. And it's kind of just de-risking the building. I often find that there's open claims against an apartment that sellers are trying to run away from and not declare. And when you have this document that says, lawyer, please investigate, the sellers have to formally declare whether there's any claims against the apartment.
Is there a way that somebody could check if any claims have been made from the insurance companies?
I'm not sure about that. I have to ask a lawyer, but often the buyer's lawyer will ask the seller's lawyer.
The seller has to declare if there are any issues.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay. So at the end of the day, we're all human. Are there any special tools or equipment that you use to check areas, let's say behind the walls or beneath the floors?
Of course.
Give us your trade secrets.
I've got moisture probes for checking moisture content, how wet a wall is. Mm-hmm. I've got thermal cameras.
Yeah.
And that tends to show up where leaks originate from and things like that.
We had a leak a few years ago in our living room. And when we called the insurance company, they came with, I think it was a thermal camera, and looked all around the walls. It was coming from the shower above. There was no water in the walls. It turns out there was just the ceiling around the bottom of the shower had worn away, and the water was seeping through and trickling down to the wall in the living room right below. So thankfully, it was not a major issue, but I guess there are ways to find it.
And I have to say, when I bought the thermal camera and I was playing with it, I looked around our house and I spotted a leak.
Really?
Based on with the thermal camera.
Really?
So yeah. So
is it common to find leaks in Israel?
Yes. There's often leaks. There's often, I would say in 80% of the properties that I check, if they're reasonably old blocks of flats or private homes, there's often a leak of some description.
Really?
But leaks are, generally they're quite straightforward fix.
So actually my brother made aliyah this past summer from London. Thank you. Thank God. He came with his wife and family. And just last week, I don't know when he moved, we moved all the bills and they put them onto my name and my phone number until he came. And I got an SMS from the water company saying that there is a leak in the house. And they actually picked up on it, the water company. He had to call the insurance company and they found that there is a pipe under the ground that's leaking. But thankfully, the water company picked up on it and communicated it, because they never would have known. They're obviously paying for this water and it can do a lot of damage. So it's good to know that somebody is on top of things, right? So you touched upon the neighbors upstairs where potentially elements could be coming from and causing damage to the apartment in question. Obviously, you're not going to start inspecting all of the properties, all the apartments that are attached to this apartment. But what about the building in general? And what about, let's say, the mahsan, the storage room that's attached to the property? Like, to what extent do you carry out your inspection?
Sure. So basically, I can inspect the outside. So if it's an apartment building, I generally inspect the outside. I always have a high level look to see if there's any evidence of subsidence or differential assessment within the building, with cracks in the facade and things like that. Mahsan, so the storage room, is often located below ground or at ground floor level, mm-hmm. whereas the apartment may be on seventh floor. Mm-hmm. So I go into them, I have a look around, but often they're completely rammed full of all the
junk.
of junk. So there's only so much I can check.
Sure. I mean, very often they are on the parking level and you see all these like water pipes in the ceiling. I'm assuming that there are leaks sometimes.
Actually, I rarely find problems in storage rooms,
good.
Which is good. And often the smell, like when you walk into it, if there has been a leak or if there is damp in it, it's an immediate giveaway because they're not always well ventilated.
So how long does an inspection usually take?
So it normally takes 2 hours. If the buyers are in town, then I often try and get them to be with me for the last 15 minutes or so, just so I can walk them around. I think it's really important for buyers who are abroad and buying a property from abroad. I meet them on Zoom and talk them through the issues of the property once the report's been prepared.
Fantastic. Well, okay, let's talk about the report.
Okay.
So you've done the inspection, obviously you take notes. I don't know if you use an iPad, you put it all into your system. You come home and then what do you do?
I come home and then I write the report.
English or Hebrew?
English. I specifically work in English, mainly because my Hebrew isn't good enough to write a report in Hebrew.
Designing buildings in Tel Aviv, it must be pretty good.
That's all right. But no, I write my reports in English.
I don't think there are too many people that can do this, actually.
There are a few of us.
Okay, but very modest. Well, that's why I brought you on. Okay, so you write the report in English. How long is it typically?
The report actually normally takes me about 8-9 hours to write, which is a long time.
Wow, that's a long time. And how many pages approximately is that depending on obviously on the property?
I mean, depends on how many issues I find, but sure. But often it could be about 30-something pages. But it's
really?
but it's normally padded out with lots of pictures.
Okay, so you go through the issues, you take pictures. Do you include like suggestions how it can be repaired, how much it would cost to repair?
Exactly. So I make recommendations and say, okay, there's a crack here. Why did the crack come about? Is it something we're concerned about? How to repair it and how much it'll cost to repair it? I also flag, I have like a traffic light system, so green, orange and red. Mm-hmm. So if there's issues, for example, there's a small crack in a wall, it's non-structural and it's completely expected, then I can just say, yeah, no problem.
We can live with it,
paint over it, done. But if it's something more sinister, for example, a leak from a pipe above, then that's actually something the lawyer needs to action. So that's when I flag it and get the lawyers involved.
What would you say the most common issues that you encounter?
Most common real issues that have impact on the contract.
Or on the decision to move ahead with the purchase.
To move ahead. They're typically water issues.
Really?
I've only ever said no, don't buy it to an apartment twice. And they were both because of water issues.
Mm-hmm. Because water issues are too complicated, too hard to repair?
So there was one place that was, I'll give one example. There was a place which was pushing 80 years old. 80 years old.
Wow, where was that?
It was in Jerusalem. It was underground. It got in and all the windows have been removed.
What do you mean it was underground?
It's below ground. Below ground level.
I see. It was like -1, -2.
Exactly.
What neighborhood?
Mesherim.
Mesherim, wow. Okay, very old.
All the windows have been removed from the rear of the apartment. The rear of the apartment wasn't underground. Mm-hmm. It was kind of set onto a slope. So there was kind of light or sunlight in the rear. All the windows have been removed. And there was this smell in the apartment. I thought, what is going on here? And I realized the more checks I did that the entire apartment was kind of underwater. They'd removed the windows to stop the smell being so bad, the smell of damp being so bad, and ventilate the place. So that was a no-go. That was a no-go. And it was for a client who was based abroad. So he hadn't seen the place.
He was very grateful.
And yeah, that was an extreme situation where often with the newer builds, it's not anything like that.
Mm-hmm. I think Mesharim and those sorts of areas are waiting for urban renewal to come and
transform it. Very much so.
Very much so. It'd be phenomenal once they get to that, but it's going to take time. So talking of water, there's a concept or there's a word here called retivut. How do you translate that, retivut? Dampness?
Damp.
Yeah.
Damp.
It's a common word that unfortunately we all learn in almost all homes in Israel. There's some patches of damp.
Sure.
Why? Why do we have this? I mean, it doesn't rain so much in Israel. It rains much more in England, for example. You know, why do we have this issue?
Two reasons. Number one, poor workmanship. When the buildings are built, they're often not sealed properly. They're often not built properly.
So the water is coming from the outside?
It can be from a number of reasons. You're right. Let's go back a step. So water can come from the ground and it can come up the walls.
Because it wasn't sealed properly, so it's got nowhere to go?
Perhaps because there's no insulation or there's no waterproofing underneath the building. And it can also be from the roof or from a balcony, where you have leaks, often due to poor waterproofing or broken waterproofing. Mm-hmm. This can be from a number of reasons. Number one, starts at the beginning, poor design. If things weren't designed to code, or there were no codes around when the building was built. For example, this place in Meshurim, there was no waterproofing there.
Right.
So that's the first issue. The next issue is when it's being built, contractors cut corners. Often when you don't have designers, so engineers and architects that supervise the construction, there's often problems which need to be rectified. And finally, it's when people do refurbishment works and they break or they damage the fabric of the building, that can then cause leaks. So for example, I inspected an apartment building in Jerusalem recently where the apartment above had refurbished their balcony. So they basically stripped the whole, all the finishes off their balcony, retiled it, and that was it.
And it looked lovely for them.
Which looked lovely for them, but that meant that in the apartment I was inspecting, there was a ton of leaks from the balcony above because they'd broken through the waterproofing in the balcony. So it's that kind of thing that like you flag beforehand, mm-hmm. and it means that it can be dealt with by the lawyers before you take ownership mm-hmm. of the apartment.
Now, let's say you do an inspection during the summer months where the dampness has dried up or they've done a nice coat of paint and they've covered it up.
Sure.
How would you find this?
It's a problem. Listen, the best time for me to do an inspection is
during the rain season.
During winter or straight after winter.
Mm. But the irony is that that's the slowest time when people buy. People usually buy when the weather perks up and days are longer.
Exactly. The other thing is a kind of a red flag is when someone's completely redone their apartment and repainted it and it's the summer, it means it's less likely that I'm able to find stuff.
Interesting.
But that doesn't mean I can't find stuff. It's still tricks of the trade.
I'm assuming that people also ask you about potential renovations that they want to do. We actually brought in last week an architect who helped us understand what can be done from planning perspective, from regulations perspective, but from an engineering perspective, do people ask you, you know, can I structurally add on a floor or a room or whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, I have high level chats with people to discuss conceptually if they can do stuff structurally. The typical thing is this a load bearing wall? Can I remove it when they want to make their place more open plan? And yeah, we have those discussions as well.
Great. So how would you say, you've spoken a number of times about the codes. How would you say the standards or the codes in Israel differ from those in the UK or the US or other countries? And what should international buyers be aware of?
I think the codes nowadays, I mean, specifically like material codes like steel and concrete, for the structural codes I can speak very confidently about, they are mainly direct copies of the European codes. Israel has adopted a number of the European standards completely. And it is still in the process of adopting more of them. In terms of those kinds of standards, we're there. We're on par with Europe.
From what year would you say that's the case?
I'm not so sure on the history, but certainly until recently, it was based on the old British standards. And more recently, like within the last few years, the codes have kind of transferred to the more advanced European standards.
Mm-hmm. Good to know.
So, yeah.
So you mentioned earlier seismic activity when we spoke about the different kind of materials that are used. As we know, Israel is located near fault lines and there are concerns about potential earthquakes, chas v'shalom. How does this affect the structural integrity of buildings and the building codes in Israel? And what should buyers keep in mind regarding this risk?
That's a really great question. Israel is expecting an earthquake probably within the next 10 years or
like
so.
Like we don't have enough problems to worry about.
Exactly. That's the bad news. The good news is we have seismic design codes. We have...
Tell us about those. What does that mean?
So we design buildings to resist earthquakes or to limit the damage in an earthquake.
Mm-hmm. How does that work? We know nothing. I know nothing. Explain to me. What does that mean?
Sure. So basically, when there's an earthquake, the ground shakes mm-hmm. and that basically makes the building shake. So you need to design the building to kind of not fall over or not cause excessive damage mm-hmm. in the event of an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
We do that in an apartment building. It's often the lift shaft, which is a continuous concrete wall.
So it's actually serving two functions.
Exactly. It was, and often serving three functions. It's acting as walls and a lift shaft is acting as a protected space in the case of rocket attack.
Mm.
And it's also resisting earthquakes. It's how the building is stabilized against earthquakes.
Mm. But I wouldn't suggest anyone go into the lift, the elevator, if God forbid there is a rocket attack because if they lose electricity.
Sure, don't go into the elevator. But the general core of the building, the stairwell and other protected kind of zones that travel up the whole building are all protected zones.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So, yeah.
Okay. So what else can you tell us about the building for earthquake protection? The foundations, are they built differently?
Not really. I spend my day designing buildings to resist earthquakes.
Really?
Yeah. So the foundations, you have two types of foundations, really, with concrete buildings. You either have piles, which are big columns that are drilled into the ground and then poured of concrete in them, and they're connected to the building.
If you go to a construction site and you get there at the very, very early stage where they're just building the foundations, you see these columns, like, and they literally pour concrete into them. I've watched that sometimes. It's very interesting.
Yeah, they can be 20 meters deep or more.
Wow.
And they drill them into the ground and then they tie those foundations into the building. So that's one option. Another option is kind of more shallow foundations, and both are acceptable. It kind of depends on what the soil conditions are like and what the ground conditions are like. Every building's different. But if a building has been designed within the last kind of 20, 30 years or even more, these kinds of things have been considered.
So you don't want to go into a building that's more than 30 years old and tell them a high riser.
Well, no, that it's a problem, actually. And that's why there's a big push to strengthen a lot of the older buildings in
Urban
Tel Aviv.
Renewal.
Exactly.
Right. We spoke in a number of the opposite episodes, we spoke about Pinoy Binoy and Tama 38, which is all part of this. You mentioned the soil conditions, and it's interesting. I often think, I mean, Israel is really a desert. It's a desert country. It's sand. So does this affect building codes and materials that are needed?
Not really. You can build on sand, you can build on clay.
So we can build in the desert? Can build cities in the desert when all the Jews come home?
Of course.
Please God.
Of course.
So don't anyone ask, where are all the Jews going to live? We have plenty of space for you.
Exactly.
You've sort of answered this question again, but I'm going to ask it anyway because maybe you have another answer. Are there any instances where you might advise the buyer not to purchase a property based on your structural findings?
The only times I've ever said it, well, there was that one time where there was the which I mentioned in Meir Shearim, and both times it's really for the same problem, which is the agent was actually hoodwinking the buyer and taking advantage of the buyer. There was a Tama project where the only apartment in the whole building that wasn't really being renovated, and they'd done stuff to strengthen it but hadn't really thought it through, and it was going to be a lifetime of pain for the buyer. And the agent knew it. I said, don't buy this building on the report.
Really?
And don't buy this apartment
on the
report.
I'm sure the agent wasn't very happy with you, but
no,
that's tough luck.
They weren't.
It comes back to the message that we give over and over, and that is about building the right team, building a team that you can trust.
Very much so.
People that are reputable, people that speak your language, that have come with good recommendations. And I'll just say here that one of the things that we do on Biden Israel is help people connect with the right professionals. So feel free to reach out if you need recommendations. Robert, what advice would you give to buyers to prepare for a structural inspection? Specifically, what questions should they ask the engineer who is conducting the inspection?
Good question. I think the advice is, firstly, what are the engineer's qualifications? Are they actually an engineer? I mean, there are a lot of people that do this that I would suggest may not be completely qualified for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to check, are they a licensed engineer, licensed architect, and how long they've been doing it for? How experienced are they?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're the main things. Often you'll get people that aren't actual engineers.
And if they've qualified outside the country, but they never got a license in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I've qualified outside the country.
But you also have a license in Israel.
I'm a registered engineer in Israel, which means I haven't actually done my licensure exam because it's in Hebrew. But it means I can still sign some stuff off in the country. But my English license, for example, means I can design high-rise towers in England and in lots of other countries in the world.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine there are too many English speakers, like native English speakers, that have that qualification in Israel.
There's one or two.
Okay. But if you're designing high-rise towers in Tel Aviv, it sounds like you know what you're doing.
I'd like to think so. You're very kind.
Do you recommend that people hire a local engineer, or does it matter where they come from?
No, I think given the construction methods are quite standard across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you need someone local that's specifically familiar with, for example, Modi Inn is built with reinforced concrete and then clad in Jerusalem stones, as are lots of other cities in the country. So I don't think local knowledge is needed. Local knowledge is, I would suggest, is Israel knowledge. And if you've got Israel knowledge and you've done this before, then you're probably familiar with it.
Okay. Before we wrap this up, Robert, I have a couple more questions, which are very important. Could you tell our listeners, where in the country do you live and What do you love about it?
What do I love about the area?
Yeah. Well, why are you there?
Why am I there? Well, I live in Hash Monaim.
Oh, that's a first for our podcast.
Which is a lovely yishuv next to Modi'in.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's about 20-minute drive. I mean, people think it's right next door, but it's...
Yeah, you're right.
20 minutes, depending on the track.
It can be longer, but, right. But can be less, depending on how you're driving. But
why are you there?
Why are we there? It's a lovely yishuv. Firstly, it's smack in between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And it means that my wife and I can work in either of the two cities. So that's the first thing. Secondly, it's a lovely, quiet, religious yishuv, but there's no cars on the street on Shabbat, which means our young children can roam freely, which is very nice. It's a lovely community, which we were welcomed into very quickly, our home very quickly.
What kind of homes do you have there?
It's mainly semi-detached and detached houses. Mm-hmm. There's one apartment building and that's it. And it's a lovely community.
It's considered to be over the green line?
Yes, it is considered to be over the green line, but it's kind of like before the wall.
Just on the border.
Yeah, it's just good. On the border. You can see the wall from Hash Monaim.
Right. Beautiful. There are a lot of Anglos there, right? A lot of English speakers.
There are, with American accents.
Okay, no comment. And finally, Robert, if you were to move, where would you go and why?
I would love to live in the north near Tiberias, overlooking the lake. That's my...
Oh, don't blame you.
That's my dream. My wife says no.
Listen to the boss.
Exactly.
Okay, well, maybe one day, please God, you'll get your way.
Exactly.
As I always say, let's hope, Bezrat Hashem, very soon the north, the south, and the entire country will be safe and secure. Robert, I can't thank you enough for your insights into the inspection process. They've been invaluable, and I'm quite sure they'll help our listeners feel more confident as they navigate their property purchase. I'll be sure to leave your contact details in the show notes so anyone who would like to reach out or schedule an inspection can do so.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you. And thank you, everyone. Please stay with us and be sure to tune in for next week's episode, which is coming very soon. Until then, thank you for joining us. Shalom and lehitraot. Thank you for listening to On the House. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and share it with your family and friends. You can also visit buyitinisrael.com, where you can find news, market updates, guidance, and much more on real estate in Israel. That's buyitinisrael.com. buyitinisrael.com. If you have a question or a specific topic you'd like us to cover on this podcast, please email us at the address you'll find at the bottom of the show notes. Whether you're thinking about Aliyah, looking for a home or a haven, or wanting to support the Israeli economy, now is the time to buy it in Israel.